Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the second episode of Elevate Your Energy Radio. My name is Evelyn Lambrecht, and you can find out more about me at healthcoachsandiego.com or elevateyourenergy.com. Also, please like the Facebook page at facebook.com/elevateyourenergy. Last week's show with Dr. Sarah Gottfried rocked. We talked about women's hormones, and we've had almost 900 listens as of tonight, which is really, really awesome in just 1 week with just social media promotion. So thank you so much. I'm so excited to get this information out there. I'm so excited for tonight's guest, Dr. Tom O'Brien. He's absolutely brilliant, and I know you're just going to be blown away by some of the information he's going to share about gluten sensitivity and its relation to women's health. His website is thedoctor.com, thedr.com. If you guys have any questions, if you're listening live, you can call into the show. The number is 347-677-0985. So, Dr. Thomas O'Brien is an internationally recognized speaker and a workshop leader specializing in gluten sensitivity and celiac disease. He's a Sherlock Holmes for chronic disease and metabolic disorders. He's a clinician par excellence in treating chronic disease and metabolic disorders from a functional medicine perspective. He holds teaching faculty positions with the Institute for Functional Medicine and the National University of Life Sciences. Dr. O'Brien is always one of the most respected, highly appreciated speakers. Dr. O'Brien's passion is in teaching the many manifestations of gluten sensitivity and celiac disease as they occur inside and outside of the intestines. Dr. O'Brien, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Awesome. So first of all, how did you become the gluten, or rather the gluten-free doctor?
There are a number of factors that came into play, I guess. Bottom line is kind of a unusual way to start the show, but this is what killed my godmother and killed my father and my mother. And they had different diagnoses. My godmother was hepatocellular carcinoma, liver cancer, turned out to be secondary to celiac disease. My father had acute MI, that's a heart attack. A fatal heart attack turned out to be secondary to elevated homocysteine levels from a folic acid deficiency because of malabsorption from celiac disease. And my mother had toxic metabolic encephalopathy, which is when the brain just stops working very well because it's toxic, which was secondary to celiac disease. And none of them were diagnosed in a timely way until there was so much tissue damage. And that's what eventually caused their deaths.
Wow.
I didn't plan on saying any of that, but that's how it began for me. I am on a mission to make sure that everyone that I can have an impact on will just consider, if they're not feeling like $1 million, or if they have some condition and it's not being taken care of to their ideals with natural care. I mean, sometimes pharmaceuticals are necessary, but you don't heal when you're on pharmaceuticals in general, long-term pharmaceuticals. So anyone who has a condition that they're not happy with or satisfied with the outcome, that they just consider maybe a common food that I'm eating every day could be contributing to this problem I have. Because gluten sensitivity and celiac disease can manifest in any tissue of the body. It just depends on where your weak link is. You know, you pull at a chain and breaks at the weak link. It's at one end, the middle, the other end. It's your heart, your liver, your ovaries, your reproductive system, your brain. Wherever your genetic weak link is, when you pull on the chain, that's where the chain's going to break. And so there are over 19,000 studies in the medical literature that identify, that talk about gluten sensitivity and celiac disease and how they manifest in any tissue of the body.
Wow.
So that's a bit of a long answer, but that's how I got into this.
Yeah. So first, what is gluten? Let's go over that.
Sure. Gluten is a family of proteins. And what we have to remember is that gluten is not bad for you. Bad gluten is bad for you. Because there's gluten in corn, there's gluten in rice, there's gluten in most grains, but there's a toxic family of glutens that are in wheat, rye, and barley. That family of gluten proteins are toxic to humans. So gluten's not bad. Bad gluten is bad.
Mm-hmm. And so you said there are over 19,000 studies in the literature. So is 'cause a lot of people think that, you know, this gluten-free is trendy right now.
Yes.
Can you touch on that?
Sure, you bet. That's because there's so much demand. There was an article last year that identified in the U.S. over 25% of the population eats gluten-free food annually. That doesn't mean they only eat gluten-free food, but they include gluten-free mm-hmm. food in their meals. 25% of the population, and it's estimated to be a $3.5 billion industry by the end of this year. So there's a lot of interest, and this is not going to go away. This is just going to be more common and more prevalent as people just consider, well, could I have a sensitivity? And then they do the right kind of tests, and, oh, my gosh, look at this, I do. And then they go on a gluten-free diet, and they feel better. They function better.
Mm-hmm.
So this whole thing, there are doctors that say a gluten-free diet is dangerous for you. And there is no evidence of a gluten-free diet being dangerous. The problems for some people with a gluten-free diet is if they rationalize poor behavior on a gluten-free diet. And I'll give you an example. Maybe you would go to Starbucks or Pete's Coffee or somewhere and get a coffee and maybe a blueberry muffin, and you get a muffin like once a week or a couple times a week. And now you go there and you're trying to eat gluten-free and see, oh, look, they've got gluten-free muffins. They're healthy for me. I can have one. As a matter of fact, I can have two. And you have them every day. And no, they're not healthy for you. They're just not bad for you. And there's a difference between being healthy and bad. So what happens is that people start indulging in fast foods that are gluten-free because they mistakenly think they're healthy for them. There's a difference between being healthy for you and being bad for you. That's
mm-hmm.
the first concept. The second concept is if people are so nutritionally depleted that they are dependent on adequate amounts of vitamins and minerals from the grains that they eat, that that's the only place where they're getting their grains, when they go off of the standard grain products and they begin eating gluten-free grain products, the gluten-free grain products are not enriched. So enrichment means with whole wheat, for example, you take wheat and you take out 32 nutrients and you put 4 back in and you can market it as enriched for you. And some people, their nutrition is so poor that their bodies depend on getting enough of the B vitamins, for example, by the bread that they eat. So if you stop eating that bread and now you begin eating gluten-free bread that is not enriched, it's conceivable that you could develop a nutrient deficiency. It's not common, but it is conceivable. And what it really means is that the person needs more education on how to eat a balanced diet.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the two ways by which a gluten-free diet may not be good for you. But in general, it's a very, very healthy diet.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's the ideal diet. It's the Mediterranean diet, just exchanging the pasta form from wheat pasta to rice pasta.
Mm-hmm. You and I were both at the Natural Products Expo a few weeks ago,
yeah.
And I said to people after that, I don't think you'll even be able to buy food with gluten in it in a couple of years anymore.
It was so surprising to see how many vendors were there with new products and how tasty they were, and you're right. I mean, it's a market that's continuing to
yeah.
improve.
Yeah. So how many people in the U.S. have... Well, actually, let's go back, and I want to distinguish first between celiac disease and gluten sensitivity and gluten intolerance. Can you touch on that?
Yes, that's a really good point. There's been a lot of confusion over the years on that, and the International Celiac Symposium occurs every 2 years, and it's where all of the experts from around the world gather and strategize and have meetings. And the last one occurred 2 years ago in Oslo. The next one is coming up this year, this summer, in Chicago. And it's all over the world, different places of the world every time. And on this last one that occurred in 2011, they finally acknowledged that there is something about gluten sensitivity without celiac disease, that it's been a big argument for many years. And they're finally acknowledging, yes, I guess there is something like that. And we're not quite sure what it is yet, and I'll get more into that in a minute. But it's finally been acknowledged, and they came out with a paper a couple of months later saying, please, all of the researchers, all of the scientists, all of the clinicians, all of the patients, can we use the same language, please? And so they asked that we use this language. The language is, at the top of the umbrella, the overlying umbrella term is gluten-related disorders. So anyone that notices a change in their body function or their blood chemistry, their immune system, that occurs because of gluten, they have a gluten-related disorder. That's the big kahuna term. They ask that we all use that. Underneath that, if you carry the genes and if you have the indicators on endoscopy, you may have celiac disease. That's on one side underneath that. On the other side, if you don't have celiac disease, you may have non-celiac gluten sensitivity. And that is as far as they've gone in the differentiations. They've asked, please, stop using the words gluten intolerance. It's a very confusing term. The result of using a term like that is that some people mistakenly believe it's like lactose intolerance, where we know that if you don't make enough of the enzyme to digest lactose, if you take the enzyme lactase, you're then able to eat the lactose-containing foods without a problem. That's not true with gluten. The enzymes do not minimize or diminish or eliminate the problems. So please stop using the word gluten intolerance. So that was their message. So it's gluten-related disorders. That's the umbrella term. And then it's either celiac disease or non-celiac gluten sensitivity.
Gotcha. So how common are both of those in the U.S.?
Oh, my goodness. Well, we know that there's over 3 million people with celiac disease, and only 1 out of 8 are diagnosed. That they find more of this when family members are tested, and you say, yep, you've got it too. And they say, well, I feel fine, and meaning that they don't have any gut problems. And that's because for every celiac patient that has gut symptoms, bloating, constipation, diarrhea, abdominal pains, for every one that has gut symptoms, there are 8 that don't. That those celiacs will have thyroid symptoms, or they have weight symptoms, or they have migraines, or headaches, or brain fog. They have some other symptoms outside of the gut. And that's why so many people are not diagnosed, because our doctors were trained in the past to believe that celiac disease was a disease of the gut. It's not a disease of the gut. It's a disease that includes the gut, but it may manifest and show symptoms anywhere else. So we know there's 3 million or more celiacs out there, but non-celiac gluten sensitivity is much, much more common. And the papers so far have come out, one paper says 6 to 1. There's at least 6 times more non-celiac gluten sensitivities than there are celiacs. Another paper said 10 to 1. When they do studies looking at how many rheumatoid arthritis patients have celiac and how many have the antibodies to gluten, it's 15 to 1. That gluten sensitivity is much, much more common than the commonly recognized celiac disease. Mm-hmm. And the test for non-celiac gluten sensitivity just came on the market just under 3 years ago. So it's still new, and many doctors don't even know about these tests. But as these tests are being done, more and more people are getting the verification. They've got a problem with gluten. It may be celiac, and it may not. But the consequences are just as severe in either case.
Mm-hmm. So I want to go back to the tests in just a moment. But someone with gluten sensitivity, would they have different symptoms than someone with celiac?
Well, that's really a good question, and the answer to that is that we don't know yet, because there hasn't been enough papers published about non-celiac gluten sensitivity. There are some, but there's nowhere near as many. You know, there's 19,000 on celiac disease, and there's less than that. Non-celiac gluten sensitivity. But there was a textbook that was just came out It's the latest textbook on the world of, it's called Advancing Medicine with Food and Nutrients. It was put out by Johns Hopkins University in December. It came out in December, and it is the go-to textbook for holistic health care, functional medicine, complementary medicine. And there's over 40 authors in there from each specialty that's talked about. And on the topic of celiac disease and non-celiac gluten sensitivity, they differentiated those conditions that have been shown in the literature to be specific for non-celiac gluten sensitivity. So this is the first publication that's looked at an overview of that. And here's what they identify with non-celiac gluten sensitivity: fatigue, schizophrenia, psychiatric diseases, depression, irritable bowel syndrome, brain atrophy, that means your brain shrinks, peripheral neuropathies, which is numbness and tingling. All of these, by the way, have been associated with celiac disease, and there are many papers on that, but these are the papers that identify it with non-celiac gluten sensitivity, so it could be either way. Cerebellar ataxia, these are elders who can't walk and keep their balance very well because their brain has been shrinking on them. Muscle pains, epilepsy and seizures, and kidney diseases. Depression, anxiety, paresthesias, bone pains, osteopenia, osteoporosis, cramps in your legs, and of course all the abdominal symptoms, and just general weakness. All of those have been shown in research papers already that they could be associated with non-celiac gluten sensitivity. They, of course, could be associated with celiac disease or from something else. The point is, if you have any of those kinds of symptoms, you just want to check. You just want to know, because if you don't identify this, everything you do is going to be dancing around in circles on that.
Mm-hmm. So what are the tests now if you were to go to your general practitioner and, you know, say that you want to get tested for gluten sensitivity? And then what's the test that you were talking about, you know, that can more accurately identify it?
Yes, good. The blood tests that have been done for many years looking for sensitivity to gluten has looked at one of the components of gluten. Let me just back up on that and say, if you consider the protein gluten, it's a protein. If you think of it like a brick wall, and digestion, when we eat a protein, digestion is getting the mortar off the bricks so that you get each individual brick, that's an amino acid. Each individual brick is by itself in your digestive tract, and then they're small enough to go right through and into the bloodstream. That's the purpose of digestion, is to break these foods down into really small little parts that the body can then use to build new muscle or new nerve hormones or more estrogen or testosterone or those types of things. When you have celiac disease, Dr. Fasano, Alessio Fasano, is a very famous researcher on celiac disease. He's at the University of Maryland, and he's an Italian guy and got a thick accent, but he says it this way. He says, if you could take the acid from your stomach and put it in a vial, and if you could put your finger in that vial, it would eat your finger to the bone in less than 1 minute. That's the hydrochloric acid that we produce in our stomach. And it can sit there all day long to digest food because the stomach, in its healthy state, has the protection where the acid doesn't eat the stomach. So you put your finger in that vial of acid, it'll eat the finger to the bone in 1 minute. You put gluten into that vial of acid, it doesn't digest the gluten at all. Humans are unable to digest the gluten in wheat, rye, and barley as it's currently on the market today because it's changed over so many times by hybridization. It's a very different product than it was in the time, in ancient times. So for all those people that say, but it's in the Bible that wheat is the staff of life, my direct answer, I look them in the eye and say, with all due respect, no one on the planet is eating the bread that Jesus Christ ate. So stop using that excuse. You cannot use the excuse of the Bible telling you to eat that food. That food is not available. If you could find that food, maybe you could eat it. But what we have now is a completely altered version that the human digestive system cannot digest, period. That's it. And for some people, and a vast majority of people, it's making them sick, and they just didn't know. So back to the digestion now. Digestion is taking the mortar off the bricks. We have each individual brick. With gluten sensitivity, you can't get the mortar off the bricks. So it's like someone took a sledgehammer to that wall and broke that wall into a bunch of pieces. There's a 33-brick piece called alpha-gliadin, a 17-brick piece, a 21-brick piece, lots of pieces or clumps of this brick. Now, the only lab test that's been available for many years has looked at a 33-brick piece called alpha-gliadin, and 50% of celiacs will have that, but the other 50% don't. And so it's been said you can't use a blood test for gluten to tell whether a person has gluten sensitivity or not, because many times it doesn't work because of the 50% that don't have a reaction to that one clump of brick. Now the tests are available that look at 10 different clumps of brick, the top 10. So you don't get the false negatives anymore. You'll certainly get it if you have the 33-brick piece, but now you have 9 other types of peptides of gluten that can be looked for. So it's very unusual to get a false negative anymore. And those tests are from a laboratory called Cyrex, C-Y-R-E-X. So if your listeners go to their doctors and say, hey, would you go take a look at CyrexLabs.com, CyrexLabs.com, and take a look at these tests. I want to have this test done because this is much more comprehensive. Then your patient or your listeners may find that a missing link, they can finally identify a missing link.
Mm-hmm. And I actually just got the test done. I'm waiting to get my results, so oh. I will post those on the internet when I get it. So you guys can
and if you like, we'll do an interpretation together of your test results.
Awesome. Thank you. What was my next question? Oh, so but someone can also go on a gluten-free diet and, you know, see if they have any, you know, if their symptoms resolve, right? That's one way to test yourself?
Absolutely, absolutely. Elimination of the food is a really good test to see how you feel. However, for some people, they'll feel better. And here's the danger. If you don't have the test result and you just do it by how you feel better, it's great. So you stay gluten-free for a while, and then you go, well, you know, you're at a party or something, and so you go ahead and have a piece of pizza, and you seem to feel okay afterwards. Mm-hmm. So I guess I can have a little bit once in a while. And if you don't have symptoms, the tendency is to think it's okay. That's not the case, because I don't know if we'll get to it very far today, but the big complication in gluten sensitivity is all of the autoimmune conditions that it might trigger and the birth defects and things like that. And you don't feel when you have a folic acid deficiency, and which puts women at high risk of birth defects. You don't feel when you have antibodies to your reproductive system, which is a very high complication for unexplained miscarriages. You don't feel when those things are happening. So how you feel when you eat a piece of pizza has no relevance to whether or not this is safe for you. So mm-hmm. The danger in going by how you feel to determine is going on a gluten-free diet good for me, you'll feel better at first and they'll validate it, but then, you know, people are human and they start to slip because it's challenging to transition your life away from the most common food that you used to eat all the time. It's challenging. And so people slack off a little, and if they feel okay, they think that it's okay to have it a little bit once in a while, and you can still get these very deadly complications.
And that's why I wanted to do the test.
Yeah, yeah. My godmother was a really good example of that. She felt fine her whole life, but it was killing off her liver little by little by little until she only had 4% of her liver left functioning, and that's when it was identified that she had a liver problem. It was never identified. She was 84. Never identified until they found out she had advanced liver cirrhosis, and that's like a severe alcoholic will have. And she had 4% of her liver left functioning, but she didn't drink at all. Never. Mm. Never. And it was from gluten. Gluten caused that. So that's why you want to do the test just to confirm whether or not you have the problem.
Mm-hmm. So can you describe what actually happens in the body when you consume gluten?
You bet. What happens is that anyone who eats gluten, they develop something called intestinal permeability. And the slang term for that is leaky gut. So some people have heard about leaky gut, but everyone and anyone that eats gluten will get intestinal permeability. For some people, it's transient, and it lasts about 5 hours, and then the gut heals itself. You know, the fastest growing cells in your body are the inside lining of your gut, and you have a whole new lining to your gut every couple, 3 days. And it's like a snake shedding its skin. You keep building new cells on the lining of your gut. So you get this intestinal permeability. For some people, it only lasts 5 hours, and then your body heals. But when you keep having the exposure again and again and again, eventually, and one study said within 36 hours, you've got long-term intestinal permeability, the leaky gut. When you have long-term intestinal permeability, you get these larger molecules going from, see, the inside of your gut's a big, long tube. It's about 25 feet long. And if you think of it, it's like a donut. And if you could take a donut and just stretch the donut 20 feet long, there's still a tube in the center, a hole in the center of that one big long stretched donut. That's our intestines. So when you eat food and you swallow food, the food is really still outside your body. It's in the tube, and it hasn't gotten inside the donut into the bloodstream yet. It's kind of an unusual concept, but it's still outside the body. Digestion is breaking down the food into all these tiny little parts, you know, one brick at a time that gets absorbed, and so then the body can take all these little parts and put them back together and make liver cells or make corticosteroids, hormones, could make thyroid hormone, can make the flushing fluid in your eyes, that our bodies make all everything we use out of the food that we eat. And in order to make the different components that it makes, the food that we eat has to be in the form that the body can use. The raw material has to be in that form. If you're building a house and the big truck comes up with a big load of lumber that's all wrapped up tight, you know, in these binds that hold it all together, and they just put that big binded bunch of lumber, 2x4s or 2x8s on the ground, they're all tied up really tight and bound together, you can't use that to build a house. You have to get the binds off of it so you can take one at a time and use it. That's what digestion is breaking down your foods into one 2x4 at a time, if I can use that visual. But what happens when you have intestinal permeability from gluten, or there are other things that can cause it, gluten's not the only one, but when you have the leaky gut, bigger molecules, bigger clumps of brick get through the lining of the intestines than should be allowed to get through. It's kind of like your intestines are lined with cheesecloth, and intestinal permeability is a tear in the cheesecloth. So these bigger molecules get in, and the result of that is they're called macromolecules, and your body makes, your immune system says, whoa, what's this? This is not good for me, and you make antibodies to the tomatoes, or antibodies to beef, or antibodies to strawberries, or antibodies to any of these larger molecules that get in. And these are the patients who have 15 or 20 different allergies on an allergy test. And they really don't have 15. They do, I guess, because their immune system's reacting. But when you heal the intestines, then they have 2 allergies, maybe 3. You know, and the other 15 just calm down. So that's what happens when you eat gluten, is that you develop this intestinal permeability. Now, what we know about intestinal permeability is that it is a precursor in the development of autoimmune diseases. Autoimmune diseases means thyroid disease, liver disease, brain diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, lupus, multiple sclerosis, that intestinal permeability has been identified as a precursor in the development of those things. So you pull at a chain and breaks the weak link. If your weak link is your reproductive system, and you get intestinal permeability, and then these macromolecules are coming in, they're pulling at the chain, your body may make antibodies to your reproductive system, and you may suffer from recurrent miscarriages, unexplained recurrent miscarriages, and that may be the mechanism that's causing it.
Wow.
Yeah, it really is a wow.
Yeah.
It really is a wow. And there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of studies on this. Evelyn, I don't think you've had a chance to be in one of my seminars yet, but in my all-day seminars, there will be 300, 400 studies that I'll go over with doctors in 8 hours, in an eight-hour seminar, just showing them what the researchers are saying. And it's not that gluten causes everything in the world. That would be utter nonsense. But gluten may cause anything in the world in terms of your body, so you just want to check and make sure that you do not have this problem.
Mm-hmm. So for someone who's not gluten sensitive or celiac, when you eat gluten, is it still a problem if you have it every once in a while?
Well, that's a really good question, and there's no evidence that it is a problem. Now, the only evidence would be studies that show people get sick eventually. But when you're diagnosed with celiac, it used to be thought that it was a children's disease, and that's just the really severe, most severe ones, is when the kids are really sick right away. But many people, the majority of people are diagnosed between the ages of 30 and 60 with celiac disease. Well, did they have celiac when they were 20? No, there was no evidence they did, but they certainly were eating gluten, causing a little bit of permeability, but the body was healing that permeability within 5 hours, and so they didn't get all of the systemic problems, but eventually they cross a threshold somewhere, and the result is the straw that broke the camel's back, and now they start getting the symptoms of the disease. So the answer to the question is, can people eat gluten once in a while and not have a problem? If you define the problem as symptoms, yes, they can, if they don't have a sensitivity. If you define the word problem as, is it causing some damage that's going to be accumulative and eventually take me down? Then the answer is no, you really can't eat gluten. So it just depends on what level you want to look at this situation.
Mm-hmm. What about cross-reactive foods? I've heard that people who have a problem with gluten can also have a problem with coffee and other foods.
That's correct. Coffee, the only one that's been proven is instant coffee, not regular coffee.
Oh, good.
So, so we don't know why that is. I mean, it may be some of the chemicals that make the instant coffee instant. I don't know. I don't know why. But there are foods that are commonly associated. And if you're sensitive to these particular foods and you eat those foods and you're gluten-free, you may still produce gluten antibodies. And those foods include dairy, yeast, instant coffee, rye, and barley. Those are the ones that we know about so far. There are others that appear to be cross-reactive. Corn is kind of questionable at this point. It appears in sensitive individuals, corn can be cross-reactive. And so you're on a gluten-free diet, you're eating corn products, which are supposed to be good for you on a gluten-free diet. But if you have a sensitivity to corn, you're making antibodies to corn, and you may still make antibodies to gluten. That seems to be, there's only one study I know on that so far, but I think there's going to be more coming out.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the tests looking at cross-reactive foods from that same laboratory, their cross-reactive food test, if you have a sensitivity to any of the foods on there, you just stay away from those foods.
Right. And can you talk about the other test that's available through Cyrex, the autoimmune, I forget what it's called?
Yes, of course.
While we're talking about that?
Yeah. This is what the entire ball game's about with wanting to avoid gluten if you have a gluten sensitivity. So the real danger is the systemic damage that occurs from eating a food that your immune system is saying, I got a problem with this. The real danger is the development of the intestinal permeability and then pulling at the chain wherever your weak link is, your brain, your reproductive system, your kidneys, your liver, wherever your weak link is. That's the danger. Notkins, N-O-T-K-I-N-S, published an article in Scientific American in March of 2007, I believe it was, and it was the cover story. It's called Predictors of Disease. And I think everyone should read that article. And if you go to scientificamerican.com, you can download that issue. It's $5, I think, to download the issue. And it's on page, I think it's 87 there. But the cover, it says Predictors of Disease. And Notkins is at UCLA, a very famous immunologist. And he talked about how antibodies are your body's way of protecting you, and sometimes they're going after your own tissue. That's what an autoimmune condition is when your immune system begins attacking itself. That's autoimmune. And he said that, you know, these autoimmune diseases, they don't begin when you get symptoms. They began years earlier, before there was enough tissue damage to cause symptoms. So, you know, someday doctors will be able to do tests to look for these antibodies that are causing damage, and you still feel fine, like my godmother. She felt fine for 83 years. You feel fine, but the damage is accumulating. And someday doctors will be able to do those tests. Now, that article came out in 2007. Well, that day has come, and the tests are now available. It's test number 5 from Cyrex Labs, and it looks at 24 different tissue antibodies, 6 for your brain, 3 for your heart, 4, 5 for your digestive system, your reproductive system, your kidneys, your liver, your adrenal glands. So they're looking for antibodies to all of these different tissues. And people are startled when they do this test to find out, my goodness, I'll tell you my example. I did this test a few years ago. It was in the research stage, and so I was one of the guinea pigs. I did this test, and it came back. I had 3 antibodies to my brain. Myelin basic protein, that's what causes MS. Ganglioside antibodies, and that's what causes numbness and tingling. And cerebellar antibodies, and that's what causes your brain to shrink, and you get you lose your balance when you're an elder because there's so much of your brain that's been destroyed already, you just can't keep your balance. I had all 3, and I said, this is a mistake.
Wow.
They said, no, it's not. I said, do it again. So we did. We know it's you. We did it again. It's accurate. And I had 3 of these antibodies, and you know, at that point, I was still doing triathlons and very healthy and eating impeccably and taking lots of vitamins and minerals. I feel pretty good in my life. I feel I'm kind of on top of the world physically, doing well. But I had these antibodies killing off my brain slowly in 3 different types of tissue in my brain. You know, it's gone now because, you know, we took care of it. But that's the value of this test, is that it can tell you what's brewing in your body. So a great explanation to the concept would be Dr. Notkin's article in Scientific American about this whole world of antibodies, looking for these antibodies before there's so much tissue damage, you get diagnosed with MS or you get diagnosed with lupus. I'll give you one example because this is so prevalent. A doctor heard about these tests and called and said, you know, my father died at 44 and my 2 brothers in their early 40s of heart disease. And I'm now in my early 40s. I'm the youngest and the only male left in the family. I went to see a cardiologist in my early 20s. I'm on a statin. That's a drug to keep cholesterol low. His cholesterol is perfect. He exercises regularly. He's got low percent body fat. His diet's really squeaky clean. And he said, but I heard about this test, and I just want to know. You know, I want to check everything I can because I'm concerned. I said, well, rightfully so. You know, the genetics of your family don't seem to be very good. And it sounds like you've done everything you can to break that pattern. All right, let's do the test. He had all 3 antibodies to his heart sky high. All 3 of them. It just dropped my jaw to see that. This is a guy who's living a very clean life, and he had these antibodies. So, and he had gluten sensitivity, and he had permeability. Now, we've not done a recheck on him. That was about 10 months ago. So it'll be interesting to see when the recheck is done. When the gluten antibodies are gone, usually wait about a year, somewhere between 6 months and a year, and then you recheck. And when the gluten antibodies are gone and the permeability is healed, then the immune system has a chance to calm down, if it's going to calm down. And there are many studies that show you can reverse some of these autoimmune conditions by going on a gluten-free diet. Not always. It'd be silly to say every autoimmune condition. But there are studies that showing those that have recurrent miscarriages, those with lupus, those with psoriasis, those with rheumatoid arthritis, that their symptoms go away, the antibodies go away. You can arrest the development of these autoimmune conditions if you get a big picture overview on them.
Wow. So then, obviously, when you find that out, you'd want to stop eating gluten. But what else, you know, is a gluten-free diet enough, or are there other things that you can do at that point?
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. The magic question. That is the magic question, Evelyn. And that's another talk, because that's a whole long lecture in itself. No, the gluten-free diet is not enough. That's a prerequisite. But you have to work with someone that knows about identifying your nutritional insufficiencies that have developed, identifying the tissue damage that's there, begin to heal that damage. Because if you're diagnosed in your 60s with gluten sensitivity, celiac disease, and you go on a gluten-free diet, you have a 3.5-fold increased risk of dying in the first year on a gluten-free diet if you're over 60. 3.5-fold increased risk of death compared to someone the same age that is not celiac on a gluten-free diet. Children, it's the same way. You diagnose children with celiac disease, they have an increased risk of early death with or without a gluten-free diet. That's only the first step. You have to be much more comprehensive than just putting them on a gluten-free diet. But the gluten-free diet is the first step in this protocol of turning their bodies around. You've got to do that first, and then you have to identify the nutrient insufficiencies and the tissue damage that has accrued.
Wow.
Yeah, it really is a wow.
So for people who are gluten sensitive or celiac, aside from the obvious food sources, so wheat, rye, barley, can you tell us some of the not so obvious food sources and then other products or things where gluten hides?
Sure. Let me say one more thing about that last piece that I just did. Mm-hmm. I always forget to do this, and I want to make sure I do that. My goal is to give this information to as many healthcare practitioners as I can so that they have the complete overview and they can begin looking for and identifying those people that need a more comprehensive picture. So we have what we call certified gluten practitioners, CGPs. And these are people who have been through my training, and they've taken the tests, and they passed the tests. And they're on my website. You'll see there's a map of the world and where the CGPs are. We just got our first one in Singapore,
nice.
Which is really great. That's very exciting. And there's a caveat on the website saying, you know, I can't tell you how these people practice, and please don't do anything they say. You know, check with your healthcare practitioner and. I can't guarantee anything about how they practice, but I can guarantee that they've been through the training and they should know about this and have a big picture umbrella overview. So you should be able to get the information you want from one of these healthcare practitioners. And there's medical doctors and chiropractors and osteopaths and nutritionists and acupuncturists who have gone through and been certified so far. So I just want to make sure. Yeah, it's a great resource for your listeners all over the world. Hopefully there's a CGP in your town or not too far away. Now, we've just started doing this, and so this is going to grow and grow exponentially. That's my vision now, and my goal is to get this to grow, get the number of CGPs and certified so that more and more people can find someone that really knows what the heck they're mm-hmm. talking about on this. So, hidden sources of gluten. Well, the most common hidden source of gluten that's surprising for people is soy sauce. That soy sauce does not need to be made with wheat, but most of it is. And you have to really read the labels in the stores, and you'll be able to find soy sauce or tamari, which is aged soy sauce, without wheat in it. It's just used as a filler, but it's commonly used now. Medications often have wheat in them. Cosmetics. You have to check your cosmetics. Shampoos. The wheat in the shampoo doesn't go through your skin or through your scalp, but you breathe it. And there are a number of studies mm-hmm. that show that when you inhale gluten, it activates the entire immune response. Lipstick. Lotions. Anything you put on your skin, on your body, or in your body. Vitamins.
Yep.
You want all of your vitamins to be gluten-free. Not wheat-free, gluten-free. And you have to be really careful of manufacturers who label their products wheat-free. Now, they're doing that purposely because they know it's a world of gluten concerns. So if they're saying wheat-free and only wheat-free, that means there's gluten in there. And it might be from barley or rye, something like that. But you want gluten-free. And manufacturers are proud to list when their products are gluten-free because it's more of a hassle for them to produce them gluten-free. And they know they're trying to reach a specific market, so they're going to tell you gluten-free if they've done the work to make sure. An example, oats. When oats grow out of the ground, there's no toxic gluten in them. When you buy oats off the shelf, there's toxic gluten in them almost all the time. And it's contamination that the truck that brought the oats to the manufacturing facility from the fields hauled wheat last week, and they don't clean the trucks. Or the silos that they store it in had wheat in it, and they don't clean the silos. So you get contamination. But there are companies that go out of their way to make sure the oats are gluten-free oats. And like Bob's Red Mill and glutenfreeoats.com, and it's not hard to find them now, but you just have to look. And what I tell all the doctors is that it's critical that they have a nutritionist, a registered dietitian, or one of their staff people who are very well trained to guide people on how to do this. It's really hard to do it on your own. You can, but you really want an expert to walk you through the process. So I'm constantly encouraging doctors to form alliances with nutritionists and registered dietitians so that the doctors send their patients to these people for the guidance on how to implement a gluten-free lifestyle. And I say, and docs, the nutritionists will refer patients back to you for the testing. So it's a win-win for both people that way.
Great. Let me get into some questions that people sent to me. Meredith asked, are celiacs affected by the ancient wheat grain einkorn? She's reading conflicting thoughts.
That's really a good question, Miriam. And the answer is yes and no. That the protein structures of einkorn wheat are very similar but not identical to the protein structures of the current wheat that's on the market. So if you have antibodies to the current wheat that's on the market, you cannot eat einkorn because it'll trigger the production of more antibodies to wheat. If you were to introduce your child to einkorn wheat as the first wheat that they're ever exposed to, there is the chance that it might be they might be able to build up resistance and resilience to the toxic wheats that they're exposed to at birthday parties and that kind of thing. And we're working on that now. We're in the process of putting the information together for a paper on that. But that's going to be a year down the road before it's published. But if you have a gluten sensitivity, bottom line, no, you cannot eat einkorn wheat because the memory B cells of wheat will recognize the einkorn as wheat, a cousin, and will produce antibodies just like it would to the wheat that you're currently eating.
And she also asked another question. She said, what about MSG in foods containing glutamates? I've read gliadin breaks down to glutamic acid in foods, I can't even read my own handwriting, contain free glutamates, often affect gluten intolerant and sensitive individuals. So should celiacs avoid all foods with glutamates?
No. You cannot avoid foods with glutamine. Glutamine is the most prevalent amino acid in our food chain. We really need glutamine. It's a building block. It's a building block amino acid for most, if not all, of our tissue. There is a problem with glutamic acid for some people. The enzyme, glutamine, produces glutamic acid, which then produces GABA in the brain. It's a three-step process. And the enzyme that converts the GABA, the glutamic acid to GABA, many times celiacs produce antibodies to that enzyme, so the enzyme doesn't work. So you get stuck with way too much glutamate. And in those people, they can't not eat glutamine because it's in any protein, but you wouldn't want to take extra glutamine necessarily, and you need to get the antibodies to the glutamate to calm down. And yes, of course, you always want to avoid glutamate exposure if it's in any of the foods like MSG. So those people that are sensitive, meaning they have antibodies to glutamic acid decarboxylase, that's the name of the enzyme, they need to avoid glutamate. But never think that you need to avoid glutamine, because then you would not be eating any protein.
Yeah. And a question from Kristen. So she was told to avoid gluten for autoimmune disease. She has lupus, but she was also diagnosed with colitis, and she was told to eat carbs and gluten to ease colitis pain. I think we know the answer, but what would you suggest she tell her doctor, or how should she go about this?
Yeah, the recommendation she got is just wrong. Eating carbs is fine, but the carbs do not have to be from toxic gluten. You certainly can eat rice. You can have amaranth and quinoa. There are other foods that you can eat if you want more carbohydrates, and for some people that may be helpful. But dealing with colitis, there's so much more that needs to be looked at. The environment of the intestines, are you making antibodies? You know, there are five different antibodies to the gut in that test that I was talking about. Are you making those antibodies? What's causing the colitis is the bottom line question. Colitis means it's an itis, like bursitis, conjunctivitis, arthritis. Colitis means you've got an itis in your gut. You've got inflammation in the gut. Well, the first thing is stop throwing gasoline on the fire. And so you have to find out what's causing the inflammation. That's a critical component. Sometimes it's what's already in your gut, and that means the environment, there's bacteria in there that shouldn't be there, or yeast infections or things like that. So you want to check that intestinal environment, and do you have enough of the good guys that are supposed to be there? Are you taking foods to help those good guys flourish? So you really want a functional medicine practitioner to be part of your healthcare team in a case like that. And you can find a functional medicine practitioner at functionalmedicine.org. That's the Institute for Functional Medicine's website. And our CGPs, our certified gluten practitioners, will know how to evaluate that gut.
Thank you. Tom, we're almost out of time. So I know we're going to have to do a whole other show about this, but I really wanted to touch on the infertility and gluten. So can you kind of talk about that?
You bet. If the weak link in your chain is in your reproductive system, maybe it's just causing poor absorption and you're not absorbing your nutrients. Well, if you don't absorb zinc, men, for example, it has a major function on sperm function. I'll just give you one example. You know, there's no way to go through all of it right now, but let me give you this example, and then we'll talk about others if there's time. When a couple mates and a man ejaculates, millions of sperm are swimming up the canal, and they hit the egg. Only one sperm gets through, sometimes two, but usually only one. How's that happen? When there are a million, they're popping up there. Well, the sperm that hits the outside of the egg, it secretes an enzyme in the head of the sperm that causes a little digestion of the force field, the mucus layer around the egg. And as soon as it digests a little bit of that mucus layer, it swims right in there, and then there's a reflex inside the egg that shuts it down and won't let any others swim through. So that's how only one sperm gets in. That enzyme secreted in the head of the sperm is completely zinc-dependent. So if the male has a zinc deficiency, he's firing duds. And males are only checked for sperm count and sperm motility. They're not checked for anything else. And if that's fine, the guy says, oh, I'm good. I'm, you know, good, healthy man. Sorry, honey, it must be you. And even though all of her tests were negative, it's the woman that's put through hormone hell many times. And when all of her tests were negative and there's no problem, and they start shotgunning in a lot of hormones. Sometimes it's very helpful, but sometimes it's a man that's got the problem and it just wasn't looked for. That's just one example of a nutrient deficiency. If you have a vitamin E deficiency, it has a tremendous amount to do with the maturation of sperm and the secretion of proteins by the prostate that carry them. But if a woman has celiac disease, their odds of having recurrent miscarriages is much higher. It's three times higher than a pregnant woman that does not have celiac disease. And when you put these women on, here's a study for you. 50% of female celiac pregnancies result in unfavorable outcomes or miscarriages. 50% of them. When they then, and that means intrauterine growth retardation, where the baby is just not developing very well, or premature births, or miscarriages. When you put them on a gluten-free diet, 7 out of 8 of them will have a healthy second pregnancy. 7 out of 8. And the first time around, and that 50% of the pregnancies for celiacs, that's a tremendous number of women that are having unexplained miscarriages. Tremendous. And it's because of this sensitivity to gluten that's causing, perhaps it's the antibodies. The antibodies are called antiphospholipid antibodies. But there are a number of mechanisms that may be at play here. That's just one of them. And there are so many studies on this that we could go through. I know we're out of time, but the basic premise is the same. If you pull at the chain, and if the chain, the weak link, is in your reproductive system, that's where the symptoms may demonstrate. And there are so many studies that say you just got to check the women. And if they have this sensitivity to gluten, put them on a gluten-free diet, and the results are tremendous. Study after study after study says this. The results are tremendous.
Wow. Very, very interesting. We'll definitely have to have you back on the show to talk more about all this.
Thank you.
Yeah. So thank you so much, Dr. O'Brien. That was absolutely phenomenal. I can't wait to have you back on the show. So.
Well, thank you. It would be a pleasure at this end also.
All righty. I'll talk to you soon. Have a great night.
Thank you. You too.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, you guys, so next week I'll be interviewing Julie Matthews about nutrition for autism and ADHD. So if you have any questions about that, you can post them on the Facebook page, facebook.com/elevateyourenergy, or you can also go to the website, elevateyourenergy.com. Thank you so much for tuning in.